Okay. I'm excited. At least I think that's what this feeling is. There's a few of them running around, but I do get excited when I'm honored to share my experience, strength, and hope, and talk about the amazing transformation that's happened in my life as a result of working the 12 steps. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank the committee. Thanks, you guys. It's it kind of overwhelmed me. The last time was my first time here at the lake, and it was a well-timed, amazing experience that helped me grow even more. My sponsor, one of my great guides, used to say, he was from Boston, and you either grow or you go. And as you'll find out, that's definitely my truth. And I would grow, and then I would go. And I'm grateful for that today. You know, there was a lot of time, there was a lot of shame there, but I'm so grateful for all of that. I'm grateful for all the people. I'm telling you, the spirits of all the men and women who reached out to me and wanted to teach me and help me find a pathway to God so that I could become the man that God wanted me to be. And everything they taught me, you know, when you know you're going to do something like this, I really hope today that I can honor at least a little bit of the amazing love that's been given to me, and I hope that I can give some of that back, you know, and honor, you know, that great power, that simple, amazing power that we get to be a part of, which is one drunk helping another drunk get sober. And for me, the definition of sober is having a relationship with a God of my understanding. You know, my first sponsor, Bobby Hansen, I asked him to be my sponsor, he said no. And then I had to manipulate people and get all these people to convince him to take me on as a sponsee. Because that's kind of how I used to roll back then, and kind of still how I roll sometimes today. But, you know, he sat down with me and he said, I talk a lot about a lot of things, honey, but I talk a lot about God. And you need to know that, and you need to know that now. And he said, I hope maybe that makes you a little uncomfortable, because then I know where we need to head. I need to make you a man who is comfortable talking about God. And this morning, I was, you know, looking through that. I love that term that I learned last night, really. I mean, I'm sure I've heard it before, but I heard it for the first time last night. Is the owner's manual, and I could certainly relate to that. And alcoholic number three, Bob Dotson, describes this scene. Yeah, he's the guy in the bed with the Bill and Bob, 12-stepped in that iconic picture. And they were sitting in his kitchen about 2 weeks after he got out of the hospital, and he was what do these guys have that I'm not getting, that I don't feel like I have? You know, I've been trying, I just can't get it. And Bill was talking to his wife, Henrietta, and I paraphrase because I'm not real good at that, and partly because my ego says I probably have a better way to say it than they did, but we're trying to work on getting that out of here. But, Bill turns to Henrietta and says, you know, I'm so grateful for this gift that God has given me that has changed my life, that I just can't stop talking about it, and I want to tell everybody. And so I'm extremely grateful that I get an opportunity right now to tell you about the gift that I'm so grateful to have gotten. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Michael. I used to say things like, oh, this was cute, and I did it for a good while because I needed attention, and I said, I'm an alcoholic with a problem named Michael. And I just thought that was so cute and unique. You know, in a lot of ways, I was cute and unique. I come from a large Irish Catholic family. For some of you, I don't have to tell you anymore. And probably for all of you, because if you go to a lot of AA meetings, sooner or later you hear about growing up Irish and Catholic. You know, for a while I was a little jealous, because I'd love to tell you that my home life was terrible. It was not. I was raised by two parents who adored each other. My memory of them as a kid is watching them light up when the other one would come in the room. And I would overhear other adults talking about those two, you know, about the love that they had for each other. And their love was definitely evidenced by two things, the Rhythm Method and 10 beautiful children. And I was fifth in the middle, fifth from the top, you know. Or as Damien sometimes reminds me, no, you were sixth from the bottom, you know. And I, you know, my parents worked real hard. That was their, like, desire and their vocation was to have a large family. And they worked really hard, and they gave us a very nice life. And, you know, a lot of times going through this journey, I felt that this part of a talk was supposed to tell you about why I became an alcoholic. You know, it's my belief today that I'm an alcoholic because God made me that way. This is who I am, and it was His way of getting me here to this moment where I get to live in His love, and I get to share His love with other people. And that was the path that He chose for me to go. Now, I certainly inserted my ego and my denial of His existence and my thing into that to take me down some pretty crazy roads, a lot of which I have in common with most of you, the consequences of being physically addicted to alcohol when that craving takes over and then there's no power left. The alcohol has the power and the drink takes the man. And that is my story pretty much. Well, not from my first drink, because my first drink was probably about 6 to 8 months old, because in our family, and I learned this because I had to do it to my younger brothers and sisters, because that is part of the whole system when you have a large family, is parenting gets taken over by the older kids, at least the chores part of it, and diaper changing and stuff like that. But when I was teething, I know that I was given scotch. And I developed a liking for that, and there was a result that came from it. I calmed down. I wasn't in distress anymore. And alcohol did that for me for a good long while, you know. So I'm going to tell you some of the things that I used to think were the reason that I drank. I drank because I liked the sense of ease and comfort produced by alcohol. Plain and simple. That's why. You taught me that. It made sense to me. I got it. You know, I didn't drink because I felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I drank because I wanted the sense of ease and comfort so that I could actually deal with life, because my reaction to life was pretty messed up, you know. It took me to those moments that everyone, I know that if you're sitting in this room, you know exactly what I'm talking about, those dark nights of the soul, those sometimes when it gets all really clear and I'm in the depths of despair and I'm lost and I'm dark and I have no light in my life. And it doesn't matter what happened before that. And then the rush to make that disappear, whether it's to take more of something to knock me out or to bring me back up to the point where I'm just not able to eat, not able to be there. The consequence is that I'm also not able to be present in my own life. You know, I'd love to tell you that, you know, the long-term sexual abuse that I suffered as a kid that ended in a, you know, with a gun pointed to my abuser's head was the reason I ended up drinking all my life. It's not. I found out now. And it's not about thinking and believing that that is what made me gay. Turns out it's not. And that if you had all the things that happened to me, you would drink too. I hung on to that for a long time. It kept me drunk for a long time. What it did is keep me away from you. So what I started like having meltdowns in like my early 20s, and they have this convenient thing called a treatment center. So when the merry-go-round starts spinning too fast and I just don't want to deal anymore, I go to a treatment center. I started off in a beautiful one on the side of a mountain in Colorado with elk in the yard and your own cabin. And it was just fabulous. I just like, I have arrived. I like this, you know. And those... the people that worked there, I was very attracted to that. I know that I needed that. I wanted that really bad. And I took to it. They even had that guy that comes in and paints and talks while he paints, and the music is nice. And at the end of it, there's a picture. And I was like, this is the bomb. I like this. I had got there from New York City, where life is crazy, and I'm clawing my way in my career to the top and doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden I'm in the mountains with elk and a painter and pretty music and, you know, sleepy time tea. It's like, I have arrived, and I, you know, I took to that, and I was introduced to the 12 steps, and I was introduced to group therapy, and that's where the problem came in. You know, no. And I learned about step 4 and 5 and went, oh boy, I'm in trouble. You know, it's just not, I knew in my heart that I can't talk to you about this stuff. I can't. And so I faked it. I did. I made up some really cool stuff. And got all through treatment. I felt like I'm going to graduate. And they had a graduation and everything. And I'm like, I'm going to be the valedictorian of this class. You know, and I got it and I went on my way. And they recommended that I go to a halfway house in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. So I went. Okay, now I'm from Miami Shores. It's, you know, right next to Miami, a cosmopolitan city. And you know, I'm a beach guy, and I grew up water skiing and fishing and all of that. And now I'm in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. And really, I went there because I just didn't want to go back to life again. I kind of liked this idea that life was stopped, you know, and I didn't want to go back to facing that because it's exhausting to cope, you know. And I knew that deep in my heart, I knew like, and I'll be drinking again. I know that. You know, so I went to Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and based on, I don't know how I finagled this, but I, you know, I had a degree, so I got to work at the State of Nebraska Office of Mental Retardation, which is exactly what they called it. I was like, so I was like put back into this crazy, like, sometimes there are spots on this in the United States that are like 20 years behind, like, the life, and there I was. And so I did not fit in there at all. The halfway house director was a woman named Honey, and she got my game. She knew it. There's something about you, Michael, and I'm going to find out what it is. Right? And I was like, I got a job. They're calling me from New York. I need to go, you know. So now you just take that, just like shampoo, and you repeat, and you rinse, and you repeat, because that was my game. That's what I ran through my 20s and 30s, was that I would work hard, and then I would play hard, and then I would go to a treatment center. Lots of fancy ones, lots of, you know, the ones the celebrities make and all of that stuff, because I'm special and I was blessed with an ability to make money in the beginning. And then I'd hang around you all and my life would get manageable. And then I'd start drifting away. You know, missing in all of this was like that path towards a relationship with a power greater than myself. I was fellowship dependent. My sobriety was totally relied on being with you. And that is a wonderful thing. It's an amazing blessing in my life to be surrounded by, I can't even talk about that because it's just completely overwhelming, the people that God puts in my life and helps me through life and helps me react the right way to what's going on in life. And it's an amazing gift. But I see, I still got to deal with 3 a.m. I got to deal with me by myself. And I kept missing that part, that's where God comes in. It's he was absent when, you know, and I tried all the things like, oh, that guy, I know that guy does the marijuana maintenance program. I'm signing up for that one. That was good. You know, I can tell you in my experience, after some science, you have to do it like 3 times to prove like that's actually what happens. Well, I did it 6 and it happens. You end up drinking again. Okay. I end up drinking again. So the other part of that thing is that the treatment centers, they get shittier and shittier. They're like not fancy anymore. They don't give you robes. They don't go, you know. They, you know, it's just a floor on a hospital or some building the county took over. And then there's really no more treatment centers. There's just detox, because that's really all that's left, you know. And peppered in there are these events that there's a thing in the grapevine, this guy, and I can't find the story. I've been looking and looking. If any of you know what this story is, I'd really love for you to tell me what issue it's in. But it was at a meeting, and this, you know, it was a grapevine meeting, and they were reading about this guy talking about, and the phrase came out like, he has failed to master the art of suicide, which I just loved that line. I thought, that's me. You know, because my life would take me there, you know. My life would take me there because I would create the illusion that I can manage my life and that I could, you know, and then eventually I pick up that first drink and then I manage that for a while and it's just 2 and then it's, and well, look, I'm talking to the experts here, so you know what happens. Till I get to those points where I don't leave the house anymore, and I only go under the cover of darkness to the liquor store to get more, to be in the house so the house is shut, because I just have to continually drink. That is my story. My story always ends, and not like once, one last time. My story ends with the torture of having the solution in my head, and I'm drinking, and I'm waking up passed out on the floor, hoping that the bottle is close enough to me that I can drink to maybe try to get to the bed again. That is where it takes me. And then from that point, there's only one way in this brain, is that it's just got to stop. And I got to stop it. You know, because it's kind of hypocritical to pray to a God that you haven't been having any kind of relationship with and ask him to take you. I didn't even bother. I just went to, I got to do this. And I can tell you that suicide is expensive. They give you tickets for it. Like, they actually write you a ticket, like a citation, for c- committing suicide, and then they give you fines. And then one time I did it in South Carolina, and I had a, it was dramatic. That was more when I was more in my, like, real drama stage. And I went to the, well, I'm always in a real drama stage, but I went out to Folly Beach early in the morning. I used to go there and swim with the dolphins, and my life had gotten a little bit better because I went back to A, because I used to live behind the dumpster on King Street, behind the McDonald's dumpster, and control all the cheeseburgers on the street and trade them for booze. That was my game. It worked really well for me. Bizarre thing is that, like, I had money in the bank and a house to live in, but I preferred to be there. And my sister, my baby sister, came looking for me. She goes, like, what's going on? And I went, well, and I actually, this was my truth. I like it here. I belong here. And I'll never forget the look in her eyes, because, and I want to stay here. Just go away. And I knew it was time to go, so I went down to Folly Beach, and I took off all my clothes, because that's traumatic, and I think, and there was nobody ever out there, and I was just going to swim, you know, into the sunrise, and, you know, all that. So love. But somebody saw me, probably because, like, who's the fool taking off all his clothes, right? And so off I go, and they call, you know, and I'm getting ready. I'm in that spot. Like, this is okay. This is a conscious decision. I wasn't totally, you know, I definitely had been drinking. But you know when you don't get drunk anymore, where it's just maintenance and stuff. So I'm functioning. So I get out there, and off I go, and I get way out there. And but yeah, in South Carolina, like, it's shallow for like a long time. I should have walked. And so I kept getting pissed off because I think, oh, like, and I'm tall, and all of a sudden, I'm like, my feet would touch the bottom, so I can't grow up. So out I go, and out I go. Well, that person called the Coast Guard, and the Coast Guard came out to find me, and they dragged me out, and they get me on the boat, and then I get a ticket, and I get a fine, and I even, and then they sent, about 3 weeks later, they sent me the gas bill for what the gas came to. Yeah. And so then I'm in another hospital room with a person assigned to watch me. That's where I get put in a bed, and then there's a person who's not a happy person. They're watching me. Okay. So we're going to jump forward now to the big one, and I knew I had failed and couldn't, and was screwing that up, and this wasn't, never once did I write a letter or call a friend or tell anybody or get that fear afterwards that people talk about after they've done the deed, like, oh, I just did this, and tell anybody. No, I've always been, but something intervenes. So this, the last time, and I'm confident to say the last time, you know, my mom had died of cancer, and I had moved in with her and taken care of her, all sober, you know, well, dry. That's it, yeah. So I'm taking care of her. Well, when they switched over from pills, because she couldn't swallow anymore, to the patch, there was a whole bottle of pharmaceutical Dilaudid left. And my disease tells me, like, well, there's some money, you know. That's where it got me. Like, I'll be taking that. Turns out that's what happened. I will take that. And so I'm back to waking up on the floor. I've got a dog, the only thing I care about that I actually, like, feed and water and do all that. And but I'm going to go, and I know the neighbors will take care of the dog, or my sister will take care of the dog. And I take the whole bottle of pharmaceutical Dilaudid and a lot of scotch, and out I go. But my dog Gypsy decides to play Lassie that day and got herself out of the back screen door. She clawed through the screen door and went through the fence to the neighbor's yard and did the little, like, rah, 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 you know? Like, oh, Lassie, you want some attention? You want us to follow you? And that's what they did. I ended up in a coma for a good while. And my family had to, I put my family in that position of like, we got to pull the plug. And you know what? And so they had decided that that's what they got to do. And they'd already cleaned out my house and divided up all my stuff and took the good stuff and gave the rest to charity. And they, I say that because it's my truth, and I need to know that because that's what we do to people. They loved me, and I put them through this. And so the day before they were going to gather to get that together, I woke up and was like, hey. And they were, you know, and I was pissed off. I was pissed. The other part that has to go with that story, because this is God working in my life when I don't even realize it or know it, okay? You know, he can send a dog to save your life or the Coast Guard, or he can make you blind. My story is that he made me blind. I contracted this weird disease. They said it's idiopathic central serous retinopathy. And idiopathic means they have no idea what causes it, so they say stress. And I said, oh, well, then I'm a candidate for that. But your vision just decreases and your retina sort of, they don't detach, they just break up in pieces. And so you can see light, a little bit of light. The color goes first, and then the light starts to dim. And you can, you know, like you won't bump into walls and shit, but you can't see anything. You can't read any signs and you can't go. So that was my condition when I took the pills and wanted to kill myself. So they treated me really rude in that hospital, and my ego was like coming out of the dark. So, and I'm like, why are you people so, you know, I'm a sick man. Why are you being so curt with me? And this nurse said to me, because honey, we're in the business of saving lives. We don't take too kindly to people who just want to destroy theirs. And that helped, you know, that, because I still remember it today. I can still see her, you know. And so here we are again in another, like, treatment center. And I'm blind, and I'm heavily medicated because they thought, like, they have no idea why I'm still alive because my organs were all assaulted for a very long time, and they said, well, at any minute, his heart or his liver or his, you know, something is just going to go. So they're like medicating me and watching me, and I'm just out of it. And then they transfer me to the flight deck, which is, you know, do I have any flight deckers here? People that like do the Thorazine shuffle and walk back and forth. And I, paper slippers, that kind of thing. And all I would do is walk up and down the hallway, and this woman would follow me. And she was interested in me. And one time I turned around and she lifted up her gown and asked me to do something. She asked me very directly to do something to her, and it woke me up. It did. And so I went to the nurse's desk after I kind of did this and sort of actually realized where I was and what was going on. And I knew where I was. You know, I knew I was in Fort Lauderdale Hospital, which also has the Pride Institute on one of the floors there. And so I went up to the desk and I said to the nurse, and I hadn't spoken to anyone. We're talking like weeks, maybe a head nod or nothing, but no words. And I went up to her and I said, I don't belong here. And she was shocked for a second that she heard my voice. And she goes, well, Michael, everyone tells me that. And I said, no, I don't belong on this floor. And that's where my freedom begins, because I said, I belong at the Pride Unit. I'm a gay man and I'm an alcoholic, and I have never said that in my entire life. Because, you know, I thought that the abuse made me gay, and so I used that, and I tormented my abuser for many years and made him carry the weight of, like, you made me this way and it's not what I want to be. Because, you know, I mean, in the 70s, it's not really a thing you want to pick. You know, if you're given a choice, you don't want to pick to be that. So I did everything I could not to be that. I can't tell you my story without telling this, because, so in not wanting to be that, and because also I experienced for the first time, like, real attraction to another soul, and a love that I had no understanding of, I met a woman and I married her, and then I hurt her. I hurt her terrible. And I needed to be free of all that, tired carrying it around. So the guy from the Pride Unit comes up, and remember, I'm still, like, heavily medicated. I can't see, and I'm still really pissed off. And he says, oh, you picked a fabulous day, because it's Labor Day weekend, and we're having a barbecue, honey, so come on with us. And I'm like, oh, shit, I might have made a mistake. But, you know, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. It's all the stuff that I've been hearing you say to me. I heard it, and I knew what it was. I needed that number 12, and I can't fake that anymore. I can't talk the stuff. I was trained as an actor, you know, and am pretty darn good at it. Made a good career of it for a while until I decided they didn't get to have all the power. I wanted to be a director, and then the director didn't really have the power. They got hired by the producer, and so the ego just kept me going up there and further away from the thing that I love to do, which is act, and be part of creating, you know, things that people will enjoy. But I heard it now. I heard things like that half measures will avail you nothing. You don't get 50% when you do half measures. You end up with nothing. I had spent a lot of years hanging on to, you know, constitutionally incapable of being honest with, just used to haunt me because I knew deep down inside that was the truth. So I met this group of men, these guys that have been around for a long time. I'm looking for him. Where is he? There he is. You know that. That they said, you want what we got, we'll show you how to get it. And that's what they did. Sometimes tough, sometimes with love. You know, some of these guys were the guys that were like, you know, it used to be illegal to be gay, if anyone doesn't know that anymore. It was like not a good idea for homosexuals to gather in a group because it's against the law. And, you know, one of my guys, you know, they've been showing me the way forever, teaches me that history that they used to have to, like, meet in houses and change the house and call each other and do that because they wanted to stay sober and they wanted to help each other do that. And they would go from Palm Beach to Broward to Dade County and switch nights. And I was learning about that and the love that they showed me. They took me on that path. I knew I needed 12, but I had to start at one. And I was finally ready. I I struggled. I was the debater, you know, this big step three struggle of why, you know. But I finally heard some things that are right there in the book, the same book I was reading from when I was 20, and now I'm like in my 40s, and I'm like reading this book, and it says, who are you to say there is no God, Moody? Where the hell do you get off, you know? And I'm hearing that for the first time, and that I get to understand him however I understand him. And I struggled for a bit, and then it said, you know, quit debating everything and everyone. And I can still hear him saying it. You know, Bobby, God bless Bobby. He had just a cute way of saying stuff, but it was always with a honey or a sweetie. But honey, you know, no one appointed you the captain of the debating society. Just give this shit up, and get, you know, and let God do the work. Get out of the way and let God do the work. And so there you have it. No, I did get to go through a lot of pain and a lot of shedding and a lot of again and again. I would love to say like, oh, I worked this stuff once. I had a, you know, big white light spiritual experience and that would be the end of my story. Ha-ha. You know, there's that step 8 and 9. That was a real challenge for me. You know, I finally found a way to trust another alcoholic and tell him everything and feel the love back from him, that it was okay and that I was, you know, okay in my brokenness, and then help shed light on the fact that I'm not going to change into the guy God wants me to be until I set some things right. And the wreckage, you know, I had done an 8th, 9th step, you know, back when it was like the other Mike, you know, and full of ego, and I, you know, did this whole East Coast amends tour and went and took people out to dinner, threw them a few bucks, aren't I fabulous? I got God in AA now, and you know, aren't you lucky I came to like set this all right? And I'm sure they're like wide-eyed going, sure, Mike, whatever, you know. Never once asked for forgiveness and never once said like, why don't you tell me what I can do to set this right? And that's where that power comes in, of having a guide, having someone who knows your brokenness and is going to help keep reminding you to ask those kind of things, Mike. Don't tell people how you're going to make amends to them. Ask them how you can set this right. And, you know, a 4-step that focuses on where I was at fault. A great lesson I learned, and I double-checked it in the book today because I still doubt myself, and sometimes I doubt all of you because I think, no, they're making that shit up. And what it doesn't say what was your part in it. You know, I was taught, if you say what's your part in it, you're implying and already alluding to their part in it. And the 4-step, the book tells us to focus on where we were. We made mistakes where we were at fault. What did we do wrong? And how did we hurt others? And we completely ignore, as best we can, what they did. What an amazing pathway to healing. Because I'm thinking like, you know, I love that never column. I had a very full never column, you know, like, oh, these I can do right now, like pay back the bank and, you know, go to the person at the store that I yelled at and say, I'm sorry, I was having a rough, you know. But the nevers, like my ex-wife, like my abuser. I mean, the concept of like, how do you do that? You ask God for help. It's really simple. And when it's time, he'll give you the help. And all I have to do is be willing. And the best of men's are the ones that just sort of came about, not the ones that I set out to do, that I knew I had to. That's house cleaning. But the spiritual transformation comes from, as long as I just say, I'm willing to do this, I can be ready when it happens. And I live in forgiveness today. I live free of all of that. That driving force in my life, the thing that identified me, the thing that like directed the way that I reacted to life, I got freedom from it because I was able to find forgiveness and I was able to let that go and apologize for the torment that I created. And I'd love to tell you that it was both ways. It wasn't, it isn't, and it doesn't matter. And I still sometimes have to be around that person, and I can hug them and say, I love you, and we can go from there. Because it's not my point to dictate when a person faces or deals or does any of that. I can only focus on where I was at fault, what I did wrong, and ask God to help me with forgiveness. So 12 years ago, and I want to hold this because Damien gave me like a really cool chip, because this past Monday I celebrated 12 years of continuous sobriety, and I I went to my home group, which was then the noon meeting, and then I had lunch with my sponsor, and at 4 o'clock, I was at a bar drinking. At 5 o'clock, I knew I had to leave the bar because my insanity is they're going to run out of vodka, and I'm getting pissed off at the other patrons who are ordering vodkas, and I'm being vocal about it because my insanity, which came back right away, is there's not going to be enough vodka. It's just crazy, but I think some of you, I'm seeing head shaking, like, oh, I get that, you know, like, and so it's really like instant fear comes in, like, you know, and terror of what do you do when there you don't have any more left and you need it. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. I got a couple of gallons and checked into a hotel room. And so here comes the fellowship again, because they just said no, you know. One of my ex-hostages / boyfriend / whatever, you know, called me out of the blue, and he goes, oh my God, your truck? And he was out there, and I went, yeah, and he goes, oh my God, are you going to commit suicide? And I'm like, well, it's crossing my mind and stuff. And he goes, you need to tell me where you are. And I was like, no, I'm not telling you where I am. And we went back and forth and a few phone calls on that and a few more vodkas. And then he takes a different tact and he says exactly what he knows to say to get me to give him the address, because we're going to have one last hoorah together before I check out. And I told him where I was, and he called everyone that he knew that was in recovery and said, Moody's over at this hotel in the penthouse, of course, and they came and got me. They said, no, you're staying with us. And they pulled me right back in. 4 hours. 4 hours that changed my life. Because that was the final part of the key, is that God works through you. That's how he's gotten every message. He doesn't, you know, they tell you to go to any length to stay sober. You can go and they'll meet you and pull you the rest of the way. Doesn't say like you have to go alone. you know, to any lengths. You can go to any lengths, but you can go. What's that African proverb that I love? It's like, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And they pulled me back in. And then, you know, in my first communion, because I'm the tall one, I got to carry the banner. You know, they make them out of burlap and felt, and they, you know, get to walk down the banner. And, you know, all that debating I did about the existence of God and what's God's like and what is he is, and I don't agree with your God, and that's kind of all of that stuff. My banner that I got to carry when I was a little boy that knew that I loved God and that God loved me. Before they taught me what sin was and that now you got to go to confession. When you get First Communion, you're pure and you're innocent and you just know I love God and God loves me. And I got to carry that banner. And that's what came back into my life, is that God is love. It's so simple. Kind of pissed me off a little bit. Like, I knew, you know, really? But when you start feeling that God is love, it's so easy to find that. You know, and I was sitting in an AA meeting, and you know, we all have 9/11 stories, and I was, you know, I mean, it's an impactful day in a lot of our lives, and the man I live with now is a first responder survivor who's, you know, he's got a story to tell. And, you know, you wonder, like, wait, that's the big thing they use now. That I certainly used it, you know. Well, how do you explain 9/11? Where was God in 9/11? And Mr. Rogers taught me where God was on 9/11. He was in my roommate who went in there to save people. He was in all the people rushing to help each other. And that's where God is. He's in the help. He's in the miracle of one drunk helping another. He's in the good morning. It's like, you all right? I haven't heard from you. You know? And then the other piece of it is, so let's talk about God. You know, I have problems with people. They irritate me still. And I know that they're all children of God. And here's the big difference. It's my measure. It really is my simple measure, is that, you know, in the back of the book, in the Spiritual Experience Appendix, the description of us is that these men have undergone a profound change in their reaction to life. That's my barometer. So now I'm going to tell you my chicken story. Okay, so I'm working hard all day. This is back a ways, but then I heard like the same story like a week or two later at a meeting. But I'm working hard all day, and I have a weakness for, well, I had a weakness for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that's what it was called back then, Kentucky Fried Chicken. And I thought about it. You know how you decide, like, I'm just going to get through this day, and I'm going to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and get my bucket and go home and watch TV and eat my chicken, right? And so I thought about it all day because it was just one thing after another. And I, at the time, I was building high rises and I'm afraid of heights, but sometimes I had to go like 36 floors up and yell at people and say, you know, and negotiate why on the 36th floor there's a trailer right there we can talk in. But rough day, and I'm out of sorts, little vertigo, and I get in the car, and I go, and I drive through to KFC, and it's taken a long time, so that always helps me. Doesn't it help you? When, you know. And I get up to the little box, the little red box, just that's like the box, and they say, and I say, you know, I wanna, and don't judge, I would like a family bucket, you know? And the little voice in the box says, sir, I'm real sorry, but we're all out of chicken. Okay. And off I go. And I know a couple of like bad words have slipped out, and I've been very good actually, because I really don't do well with the language adjustment. But I let it fly, and how on earth you out of chicken? And what? And it's a chicken place, you know. And how does that happen? How does that even happen? You know, just like oh, right. And I go on, like, I'm off, and it's not stopping, and then I finally, like, wind down, and I'm, like, just out of breath and energy, because I haven't had anything to eat yet, and there's a beat and some silence, and then the little box just says, okay, sir, but we're still out of chicken. And so then I'm presented with a choice, right? And I'm grateful that today I can say, you know, well, I think I said, well, of course you are. And I apologize for that. And I know she had nothing to do with, I mean, the fact that there's no chicken at a place that has chicken in the name. But my reaction to life gets to change and grow all the time. So I just have to take one more minute, you know, because I consciously didn't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I do have to honor a couple of people and hopefully add some comfort and some strength and hope. You know, last 3 years life has been not as I would have it. You know, it's had a lot of love in its life, and the byproduct of love, I'm sorry, it's true, is pain. The more you love, when the love goes away, it hurts. It hurts terrible. And, you know, I, my partner and my older sister died on the same day. And my, you know, my partner, a long time in hospice. And just last week, I lost my sponsor and longtime friend, you know, like 20 years. We were sponsee brothers, and then when our sponsor died, he became my sponsor, Frankie G. And this is what I have to share with you. You know, I got to watch my partner go, and I got to give him as much love and peace and serenity as I could. You know, I had, but he was afraid of dying. He was in fear. He had gone out again, and I had, you know, we had decided to start living separate lives, but I was still his guy, you know, and he needed me, and I watched someone who was afraid of dying and who was did not have a relationship with God, and I'm happy to say that my sister, she died sober. She died lost. She died like what? You know, she had early onset dementia. And she just died in her car at Publix because she panicked and thought her keys were missing. And she just, it was 90 degrees that day. And, you know, they called from hospice to tell me that Marshall had passed when the next morning was when we were going to pull the plug on my sister. So that's kind of what? And I could just hear Bobby's voice saying, just, honey, quit the debating society. Just let God love you through this. And he has surrounded me with love. That's where God is. And this past month of shock and craziness and out of the blue that, you know, my sponsor Frankie, and what's time for him to go? I watched a man who loved God and knew that God loved him and wasn't afraid of dying. And let me tell you, my wish for all of you is that you stay on this path. Let God love you through other people so that you can, when that day comes, go in peace. Thanks so much for letting me share. I really appreciate it.